and welcome to episode 4 of Meeple Skills, the only podcast that knows that the best way to wake up Sansa Stark is to softly turn her. Get it? It's played by Sophie Turner. Softly turn her.
Ha, 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 ha.
Anyway, I'm one of your hosts, Ethan Richardson, and I'm here with a little different roster than normal. I'm here with my lovely wife,
Jackie Lemmer,
as well as our new co-host,
Alyssa Sexton.
She's got sex in her name.
You know what?
Look. So Alyssa is joining us to try and make things more interesting because I am not. We've often thought about adding a third to the podcast, not the marriage. Anyway, so we're going to talk about the best thing ever, and that's Game of Thrones.
Board games.
Yes, Game of Thrones board games.
The best thing ever is board games,
though. But let's be honest, did you catch that premiere episode this week? No, you didn't. Neither one of you watched Game of Thrones. This episode is for me. And I'm gonna make them work this episode for me. So we are going to review a Game of Thrones the board game, a Song of Ice and Fire miniatures game, a Game of Thrones Hand of the King.
Hand to the King.
Is that the title of the game?
Yeah.
That's a weird. All right. And a Game of Thrones Catan. Is this an expansion, Brotherhood of the Watch?
It's not an expansion. It's just a Game of Thrones Catan, Brotherhood of the Watch.
That's really an annoying name.
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
All right. So, I am going to get us started with a Song of Ice and Fire miniatures game from Come On Games.
It's pronounced Seamon.
Oh, it's Come On.
Seamon.
Come on.
They get a little irritated when you don't pronounce their name right.
Come on.
Anyway, so yes, Alyssa, me, and Player 3, which is also known as Alyssa's boyfriend, but for the fun of this podcast, I've decided he is now only Player 3.
Acceptable.
Spent a good portion of a Saturday figuring this game out. So I was maybe not mentally prepared enough to really have taken on this game because none of us are war gamers. And I, in my stupidity, was like, hey, I've played a war game one time. I can totally read these directions and teach these people how to play it and we'll figure it out all together. It'll be great. 4 hours later, we had the board set up. It's a lot. Like, it's a good game, but it is a lot. The game has 6 different modes of play, and we thought in order to pick the easiest one, we would do this tower defense version, where literally there's one person attacking and the other person is holding their own at the defense of the tower. And it was pretty easy to set up, and it is a good way to get a feel for how the movement works and the different game mechanics that you're going to be using in this game. So it wasn't too bad of a choice, but it was definitely still a lot. And of course, we were playing just the base game, which is the Starks versus Lannister core set.
Yeah, no, a lot is a bit of an understatement. I'm going to be real. Wow. That's about all I have to say about that setup time. Wow.
Yeah, certain point, Alyssa was just like, I think I'm gonna just sit here and watch you guys figure it out.
Yep, definitely sat that one out. Glad I did.
Just a little bit. I'm kind of bummed I missed the witnessing that happen.
I'm sure the D&D group that was upstairs with us thought it was great.
So I'm just gonna interject quick because when this game was announced on Kickstarter, I was stoked for it. And then I didn't buy it. And then I didn't get it. And then y'all scheduled your little party of mini game without me. So I was bummed, and I just want it to be on the record that I was very bummed.
So the game is actually pretty straightforward play. As someone who isn't typically a war gamer, I think this is actually a good place to start. Because once you get into it, the rules made sense. The movement works a lot like X-Wing, where you measure and you pivot and the movement, to me, was very simple. which to me was a lot of the more terrifying part of setting up the board, is because it takes up an entire table. Like, you have to have a giant table to play this game. And as I'm looking at all the space, I'm like, I don't even know where to start. Where do I even want to put my people? I don't know. So realizing that the movement worked similar to X-Wing calmed me down quite a bit, made me feel a little bit more confident. Another thing that they do in this game that's really cool is that the units work as vehicles, which makes the movement easier to track, and it also makes it easier to keep track of your units. And they use the vehicle method also when it comes to figuring out how your deaths work or how your people escape. So that was pretty handy as well. The combat works by rolling d6s and then comparing the success rolls to the opponent's failure rolls. And you'll have cards that talk about the different units, and those show you what are the success rolls and what lower would be a failure roll, of course. The difference between the two rolls decides how many soldiers the loser is going to lose. The biggest issue is if you lose, you have to make insanity rolls. These rolls cause you to lose soldiers, and the flavor is that the soldiers just kind of ran away. Like, oh, we're losing, so they have just ran for the hills. Or in some cases you can roll insanity rolls because something horrifying happened on the battlefield, and then that also causes your soldiers to run away. That is the big kicker and something you really have to watch out for in this game, because we lost more soldiers on both sides due to insanity rolls than we actually did battling, because we both had ways to make it so that we could heal our wounds, which meant more soldiers magically came back. I don't really know how that is supposed to work flavor-wise. Like, they ran away, but then they decided they felt bad, so they came back.
Probably the best way to describe that, most likely.
Exactly. That was an interesting mechanic, but it's honestly the easiest way to get rid of somebody's army. Or unit, I should say. One of the unique factors this game brings to wargaming, and like I've mentioned, I have limited experience with this, but it's the use of the non-combatants. Some of the main characters from the series are labeled as strict non-combatants, and some of them can actually be used as either non-combatants or as heroes in your units. Non-combatants are placed on an abilities board that unlock different abilities, which is extra cool because sometimes your non-combatants have extra abilities that trigger when you trigger certain abilities. So you get this long line of things triggering, and it's great! Especially for those magic players out there who really like being able to do that kind of thing. Or Yu-Gi-Oh! Who set traps. Anyway, some of the characters such as like Catelyn Stark, she is one of them that has those abilities. You place her on a certain part of the board and she has another ability that works in tandem with that. The tower defense mode makes one house be the group defending the castle and the other is the attacking. There are terrain plots that you can that cause insanity rolls, but then there's also terrain plots that can give you good points. There was a tree, for example, that would actually help you have better chances of rolling better. The plots that are bad that cause the insanity rolls are usually these giant plots of bodies. And if a whole unit is wiped out, it creates another plot with a whole bunch of bodies on it. So then there's more and more chances of having to make more and more insanity rolls. So yeah, this was a lot for this game. Alyssa, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, a lot's definitely a good way to put it. First of all, the minis for this game look absolutely fantastic. They did an amazing job, even unpainted. The minis looked really, really cool. Even like the portions for like the wall and stuff. Everything looked really nice. Setup time for first-time players is going to be a journey. It's a journey of learning. I do like that the movement works the same way that X-Wing does, because I've played X-Wing, so I have that basis of knowledge at least. I don't know how I feel about it, though, as far as if I actually like it or if I don't. I would probably have to actually play it instead of watching. It does take up a lot of space, though. Even compared to X-Wing, it takes up a lot of space. That's my only concern. For some people, you might be having to play on the floor versus being able to play on a table. Because I know I don't have a table big enough to play that game. And it's a nice game, and they've got tons and tons and tons of expansions, which is really cool. But it's definitely, it's an investment, and it's definitely a time investment as well. Which, and it's a war game, so you kind of expect that.
Yeah, and with the miniatures, that's the other thing. Since we were playing with only the base set, we only had three types of units. I played as the Starks, and we had the cavalry, and then there was berserkers and just regular foot soldiers. And I think that's part of the reason we maybe didn't enjoy it as much as we would have, because there are archers and things like that, but those have to be purchased separately. And we were using the game store's demo copy, because shockingly none of us had backed it on Kickstarter, and none of us had $150 just lying around to purchase the game. So we were playing the demo copy, and there wasn't any of those extras in it, and it confused us because we're looking at all these rules, and there's rules for how ranged weapons work, and rules for how different monstrosities work, and we're like, well, where are those at?
Right, and I thought that was a little weird to not include in the base set. Like, even if you're not giving, like, you don't have to put every single type in, but to not have, there was, like, two different kinds of just regular, like, foot, like, essentially foot soldiers, but there was no archers, but we had cavalry. It just seemed like a weird mix to put in there. And then the, like, generals and, like, the leaders of the unit were really hard to decipher from the regular ones. Sometimes they had, like, a little extra banner, or sometimes they were holding their sword differently. So it made, like, sorting pieces a bit of a nightmare, at least initially. Once we figured it out, it was fine. But sorting through all the pieces when we first got it open was interesting.
Yeah, definitely one of those that as you're painting the minis, you definitely want to take care to paint your heroes to be very different from the rest of them.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also with the cards, like I mentioned that there's a difference between the non-combatants and the regular combatants. And that is quite an issue because we had a heck of a time deciphering which card went with which position. Because like Rob Stark's card, he has a position as a non-combatant that allows you to be able to move faster. But we're like, well, how does that work? Like, can he just do this all the time? Does he have to be, like, tapped, essentially, to do it? Does he have to be placed on the abilities board to be able to do it? It wasn't very clear on how you utilize that. But then, of course, if you use Rob Stark as a combatant, you don't get the speed boost, but then you get his direwolf.
Right. That was another weird thing, was, like, trying to figure out, like, which characters were actually non-combatants and which ones were, because there were characters that had non-combatant cards, but they weren't marked as non-combatant cards. So they looked like the combatant cards, but the descriptions were different, mm-hmm. which made it really difficult to figure out, okay, is this, like, which card am I supposed to use? Like, I don't really know. We're gonna wing it and hope for the best. And while the rules, for the most part, did explain the mechanics for the game really well, I don't think it explained the combatant versus non-combatant card, because it showed that they would be marked non-combatant, but then there were cards that were not marked non-combatant. And that could be because of the demo. We had that demo copy, mm-hmm. and maybe that's been changed, because we haven't bought, like, a retail, like, in-store copy, so and that could have been changed, but I don't know if that's been changed or not.
Yeah, we did actually cave. Ethan and I caved and bought a copy, partially because we were able to buy it from a friend. So now we do have a copy of A Song of Fire and Ice and Fire, A Song of Ice and Fire miniatures game. We got it with all of the expansions, so we do now have archers.
Nice.
But now we need to play it again.
I know they're also doing tournaments for that as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was a game store in Overland Park that was running a weekend of tournaments for Ice and Fire.
I did not know that.
I didn't either until I showed up. Oh. It was pretty neat. It was pretty neat. And they had a good chunk of the expansion, so it's cool to see the expansions are actually in stores and not just through the websites. You don't have to worry about shipping and them getting destroyed.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, because yikes, I'd be
pissed. Did you sit down and play, or did you just watch?
We watched.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was cool.
Oh, wow. I guess I was going to add to this game that I played against player 3, and I ultimately lost. I was the attacker attacking the wall. He got to be the defender. He set up all of the terrain issues so that I was basically bottlenecked into attacking his wall, but it had taken us 4.5 hours to figure out how to play, so I didn't really care very hard, and I was basically kamikazeing it and throwing all of my units into it because I was really tired and really wanted food at that point. We weren't very bright. That was part of why I said we weren't very prepared. We really should have had pizza with us or something.
I just didn't expect setup to take that long. Like, yeah, that was a journey. That's mm-hmm. where I'm gonna leave it at. That was a journey.
So yeah, when you're playing in the tower defense mode, the people who are defending the tower, shockingly, have a little bit of an advantage, especially with the base game, because if you are playing tower defense mode, it is automatically assumed that you have a certain number of archers on your wall. So the wall can shoot you, which also sucks for my cavalry, which didn't last very long.
No, they didn't. It was pretty funny.
No, they had more hit points than anything else, but they were down first.
Yeah.
Of course, I ran them in first.
It was pretty funny to watch.
And then afterwards, Ethan informed me that you always send in the cavalry last.
That is how military strategy works.
I haven't really studied military strategy all that much until this point.
But you know who has?
Who has?
Your husband.
Nuh-uh.
Yes.
You can barely read.
That's also true. So, alright, did I miss our 1 through 10 rating?
No, we're just about to start.
Perfect. So where would you rate it, Jackie?
I'm actually... I'm stuck between a 6 and a 7. It's a 7 because it's really good. The miniatures are gorgeous. I think it's overall a really good game. To me, the biggest issue with it was I think the rulebook was written in the worst possible way. Instead of showing you, like, how to set up the game in these different ways right away, and then showing you the rules, and then going into, like, the weird one-off rules, it just kind of threw everything at you all at once. It's like, here's the different modes of play. Oh, also, here's how the game works, and then a little bit later, and here's how you would set it up. And so it's like, you're just flipping back and forth constantly, and I think that could have been streamlined quite a bit more. So that's kind of why I was thinking more a 6, so maybe a 6.5?
That's allowed.
Okay, I'll do a 6.5. How about you, Alyssa?
We're gonna take it down a tiny bit of a notch. We're going with a 5. Aesthetics, I appreciate. That, I would give a solid 10, because the aesthetics of that game are fantastic. The miniatures look great. Especially if you're into painting, dope. That rulebook is, I'm gonna go with exactly what you said. I didn't like it. It doesn't make sense to have the mechanics in the order that they were in the front of the book, and then have the mechanics in there before you even set up the board.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when the mechanics aren't that different from other games. And not all the mechanics were actually explained very well. Some of them were really detailed, and then others of them were weirdly vague. And the pictures that went with were fine, but if they were going to be vague, it needed to be more detailed in at least the images that were being shown. So, yeah, we're going with a 5. I did not. This was the one I liked the least. I'm going to be real.
I haven't played it, so I don't have a rating for it.
Sorry, babe.
Since, I wasn't invited, but that's fine.
You were invited. You were busy.
Look, I'm an important person. Anyway, so friend or foe, how likely are you to murder the person you play this against?
This is risk level to the extreme. Is there such a thing as extreme risk?
Extreme risk. Yeah, it's called actual war.
Yeah. We played actual war. Player 3 didn't want to talk to me afterwards, but that's okay. I didn't want to talk to player 3 after it was over also.
That was also pretty funny. That's pretty good.
All right, we got some salty sailors. That's fine.
I mean, it was partially because we were hungry, but...
Right.
Really, I think it would depend on how I lost to be, that would just be the issue. Like, if it was just like, if it was a close game, I would say Monopoly. Well, we might talk in a few hours. But like, if there's shenanigans, it's risk and we're not going to talk for the next couple days.
So, do you think that there's anything in particular about the game and its mechanics that lead to that, it being that high on the scale? Or is it completely... driven based on the skill level of the players?
That's a great question.
Because, I mean, that's really what we're boiling down this friend or foe scale is. What is it about the game itself that makes you feel that way?
I mean, it's definitely because you are pitted against somebody in a game that does require quite a bit of skill, requires a lot of thinking, a lot of strategy. And so it's... I mean, you can also play it without those things, but, and because it is such a time commitment, that by the time you're done, like, if you didn't win, or if you just got totally creamed by the other person, you feel very distraught over the whole thing, because it's like, I worked so hard, and you killed all of my units!
Not gonna lie, I'd be pretty angry if, because of my own stupidity or my inability to play this game, the game ended in 20 minutes when it took me an hour and a half to set it up. I don't even care how I lost. If that game was 20 okay. minutes or 30 minutes, I'd be pissed.
Sure, no, that makes sense. Okay, any final thoughts on A Song of Ice and Fire miniatures game?
I think if you're used to war games, it's probably fine. Cool. And honestly, probably after a few times, thoughts might change, but it would depend on expansions as well.
Very cool. Okay, so moving on to a Game of Thrones, the board game. I didn't get to play this one either, so what's this one all about?
This one is actually also a miniatures game. The miniatures are a little bit different. This one only took 2 hours to figure out, which was impressive. And it's more of like an area control game, and it's by Fantasy Flight. It takes 3 to 6 players, which is kind of nice. I think Ice and Fire was only 2-player.
Yeah.
Which, if you want to play with more than just one other person, is a problem. On each turn, except for the first turn, there's different types of cards that you reveal during 3 stages, and then these decide whether or not you get new units, if there's a wildling attack, or just a whole bunch of other random crap. Then, you know, once those cards are revealed, each player uses their order tokens, which tell the units what they're going to be doing, whether that's raiding or collecting power or anything along those lines. We are ordered to resolve in a kind of turn-based system, so player 1, player 2, player 3, and then you do your next set, player 1, player 2, player 3. Those orders are going to be resolved in the order of the Iron Throne track. Heads up, Lannisters, they get to start on number 1. Just kind of nice, just saying. Each house seems to kind of have their one thing that they're good at. I want to say there was maybe one that was just kind of not good at anything.
Yeah, I want to say it was the desert people.
It was.
They were just like the most mediocre family.
They were average.
And that, I think, is an accurate representation of that season that they were heavily featured in of Game of Thrones. So.
What were the desert people called?
Was it Sunspear?
I don't remember what they were called, but I remember they were... Which desert people?
Their little symbol was a sun with a spear. I think a spear through its face.
Okay. Moving on. This is unimportant.
So, once you do your orders, units are moved. Then wars may or may not break out. Wars usually only happen as a result of like you're pushing an army back, or you're trying to get new territories. You can either get more power, get more supplies to feed said armies. Or if you've got somebody cornered and you're trying to just take over a territory so you can get extra victory points.
They're the Dornish.
Is that the name?
They're from Dorne. The castle is called Sunspear.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yes, and it's House Martell.
House Martell is
the house that rules Dorne. I couldn't remember. They had I think that was the guy who got his face crushed by the mountain in the series. Spoilers for like season 5, you slackers.
that's the best way to describe that game. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jackie?
I really, really enjoyed this game. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this game because I was a little hesitant after A Song of Ice and Fire, and I was more prepared this time, even though I didn't need to be. But it's really good. Once again, I thought the rules were not too bad to figure out. It's still very high strategy, high level thinking, but it wasn't as bad as, of course, A Song of Ice and Fire. There were some rules that I misinterpreted. I did not realize that the siege engines, if you are using them to defend your spaces, have to be used at a distance, and you can't have it in the same spot as the thing you're trying to hit unless you're using them to attack, which really worked out to my disadvantage as player 3 started taking my territory. Was really rude. I thought I had this giant siege engine, and I was like, "Mwaha! Player 3 has fallen into my trap, and I shall now use my siege engine." And he was like, "It doesn't work that way." And I was like, "Oh crap, it doesn't." And so I had this useless siege engine that I then had to move out of the way. It was ridiculous. So there were some little things like that. Overall, really enjoyed it. The art is good. I kind of liked how every house, as Alyssa said, had its own thing that made it good. I haven't watched the series, but I know what it happens in it, and I've been told all the things that go on for Game of Thrones, and so I kind of liked the flavor of all those different things. I really liked the flavor of the different houses. The disadvantage to that, though, was that House Lannister starts off in a very advantageous position. I know! Both the Lannisters and the Starks have probably the most advantage. The Starks, because they kind of have the biggest landmass and it's up in the north, and so they don't have a whole lot surrounding them. The Lannisters, of course, have the advantage because they're the frickin' Lannisters.
And money, money!
Yeah, and currently they're the ones closest to the throne. Therefore, they get to start off at the top of all the trackers, which includes going first, which is freaking cheating. Even though it's the rules.
Going first is cheating?
It is cheating!
Every single game has a player who goes first.
But he gets to go first just because he was playing the Lannisters.
Yeah, it's like real life. If you have more money, you get a head start.
Hurts, doesn't it?
What did you think, Alyssa?
I am upset by the Iron Throne token that lets you break all ties, including bidding, which I call shenanigans about. The sword I had was great until I didn't have it anymore.
Oh.
And I started with it, which was cool, and then I didn't get to use it, and then when I needed it, the person playing the Lannisters had it. He had it the rest of the game, and I might be a little still salty about it. The mechanics of the tokens, cool. I like them. The bidding, the secret bidding process was also kind of neat. Play the Lannisters if you want to win. Mostly them or... What was that house I played with the squids?
I don't remember the name of them, but they had Greyjoy.
Yeah, them. Play them also because between the two of them, they have lots of resources right immediately near them. The Greyjoys started with boats, which I think they started with two instead of just one. Should have taken advantage of that. I didn't. But yeah, I mean, compared to the previous game, I liked this one much better. Less salty about this game. Flavor was good. The aesthetics of the game was good. I wish there were less tokens. Like that seems like a weird thing to not like, but there's a lot of little bits. Yeah. Lots of little bits. And I'm not a fan. I got dogs. I got dogs that are into stuff. That's a problem.
Ooh, and we have a cat who likes to knock little bits off the table. So.
Yeah. Yeah, there was...
Yikes.
The tokens Alyssa's talking about, there's three tokens that were handed to whoever was at the highest point in that track. So there was, like, a Valyrian blade, and that gave you advantage in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the throne token, which gave you... That's... You got to go first, and you got to break all ties, which went to the Lannisters.
Shenanigans.
Yeah. And then there was a Raven token, and the Raven token allowed you to change one of your orders after the orders had been revealed. So you could, like, change up, make yourself not go to war, or make your stuff go to war better.
Mm-hmm.
That would work that way. So, and then, yeah, all the little pieces, because all of the little siege engines have a cute little piece, and all the little footmen, and then you got your little knights, which do look like knights from chess. Little knights. They're so cute.
I appreciate the pieces.
Yeah,
the pieces are cute. I think if we had played with more people, the game would have been more difficult and potentially more interesting, because with three people and all of us being close together, it made expanding hard, but also kind of easy at the same time, because then I just went north and you went south, and then player three just took everything mm-hmm. in the middle, and then he started taking your stuff too.
Yeah,
freaking player three, man.
I know, right?
That guy.
Yep. As a three-player game, we had a lot of time to build up our resources and to build up our armies before we started hitting each other. And from what I've heard, in a six-player game, you don't get that. Like, it's immediate that you start hitting people because there's nowhere to expand to.
Right, there's no room, because if there had been somebody who played Stark and Lannister, the Greyjoys are literally right in between, and there's maybe one or two plots literally in between them that aren't sea-based. And there's not a ton of sea-based territories either. Which you can move units, but it's inconvenient. And, you know, boats. They know you're going to use boats. So then other people make boats. And then your plan's ruined.
Like player three.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I played as the tulip people.
The tulip. people.
It was a rose. Oh. It was green.
A green rose, and they were in the middle. They were supposed to be kind of like the agrarians.
That's, House, shit, don't tell me. I know this one. That's the Tyrells.
Tyrell, yes.
That's House Tyrell. I couldn't remember the name on that one.
Yep. House Tyrell, they were supposed to be the agrarians. I thought that would mean that I had a lot of food to feed my armies. Turns out I expanded in the wrong direction. If you expand north towards the Lannisters, you get a lot more food. But I expanded south because it meant not going towards the Lannisters. And that was a bad choice because then I did end up losing a couple units because I wasn't able to feed everybody.
I think I had that same issue too, actually.
Yeah.
Not enough food.
Stupid Lannisters.
Shit happens.
They have all the things.
No, it's just the money.
Yeah.
Actually, the money helped a lot because as soon as he had all those power tokens, he just destroyed us and all the bidding. It was disgusting. Yeah. Honestly.
Yeah. So that was a Game of Thrones, the board game.
The board game. 1 out of 10. What do you give it?
I liked it. I put it like 8 or 9.
Eight or nine?
I actually really like...
That's a friggin' endorsement.
As far as miniature, like... this kind of area control game, which I'm garbage at. I'm so bad at these games. I liked it. I will get salty and I will be upset if I lose, but I will play it.
8 or 9. All right, Jackie.
I'd have to say around an 8 also. I'd give it an 8 because it was really fun. The rules weren't terrible. There's just some like little nitpicky rules that I had issues figuring out. But, I mean, we could still play the game without those weird nitpicky things that I had issues figuring out. The rule book was well laid out. It's, of course, good aesthetically, so I really don't have any complaints. I'd play it again. I actually kind of want to buy it, but I already bought, like, way too many games.
If I'd played it, I would probably also give it a high score.
I bet you would have.
You probably also would have beaten Player 3.
Yeah.
Or you would have at least given him a run for his money.
Yeah, probably. All right, friend or foe, what are we rating it at? Who are you gonna murder all your friends as they stab you in the back and take the Iron Throne?
I'm competitive, so yes, always.
so
but,
I have a feeling that every game you're gonna rate is gonna be high on.
Right. You're not wrong, but okay. I will say, I would probably give it like, I would go on the low end, probably like Uno. Like,
really? Okay.
Like, especially if it's just like a chill, like we're having like beers or something, and we're just playing, hanging out, and we play this, I'd probably be good. I'm going to be mad if I don't win. But I won't throw the pieces, lose the pieces, and I won't blame anybody else but myself.
Okay. So you think that the strategy is deep enough that like you kind of put yourself into positions to do poorly?
Oh, definitely. Okay. Yeah, 100%. Okay.
There's not anything in the game itself that forces you into those.
No, not really. Okay. Unless you play that one house that just isn't very good at
sure
anything.
Right. Poor Which things. Is...
The Dorians?
The Dornish?
Dornish. Definitely wasn't the Dorians. I didn't want to say it and mess it up, so thank you for doing that for
the
me.
The Dorians?
The Dornish. Yeah, okay, okay. Jackie, are you going to murder anyone to get the Iron Throne? Or are you going to murder anyone if they take the Iron Throne from you?
I honestly think this is more at a Monopoly level. Sure. Not quite Risk, because, yeah, it is really fun, and there are ways for you to win as the other houses, like, and you already know when you start what your disadvantages are, and you know what your strengths are, so you can play to those strengths. However, I still want to call shenanigans on, like, where you get to start on the tracker, because the Lannisters get to start at the beginning of the trackers in almost everything. So they, even if they only have the Iron Throne token at the beginning, it doesn't take them much to be able to get the other tokens as well, which is infuriating. And so, yeah, I could see myself potentially table flipping over this or board flipping.
So really, the valid strategy is if you're playing with more than just one person and somebody's playing the Lannisters, everybody just... You just hop on that one person, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's not fair, and that's not nice. But it might be a good game for everybody else.
Now, I'm not super familiar with the mechanics of the game, but it's important to keep in mind that a Lannister always pays their debts. So, if you're playing the game of Thrones, game, then maybe you team up with the Lannisters and then betray them at the last minute.
That's fair also.
But they could betray you first.
That's kind of what they do.
Yeah.
All right. So next up we have a Game of Thrones Catan Brotherhood of the Watch Electric Boogaloo. All right. So we're going to preface this by saying our podcast has a very strict stance on Catan games in Catan. And that's that we hate them. And by we, I mean Alyssa and myself.
Awful.
But we had to make an exception for Game of Thrones Catan. Jackie, tell me about it.
So, Game of Thrones Catan is for 3 to 4 players and is produced by Fantasy Flight, just like a Game of Thrones the board game. And it is your basic Catan game. You set up the board, you have your little trade ports, and you have your settlements, and you generate resources by rolling dice. And the first person to get 10 victory points before your opponents wins. So, pretty basic Catan. However, I will have to say that a Game of Thrones Catan is probably the best version of Catan I have played so far, because the additions to the game just give you something else to do and makes it move a little better. It's still really slow, though, which is the one thing I don't like so much about Catan. I like Catan better than these other two, but... like, it is still very slow and can be even worse, depending on how your rolls are going. So this new addition adds character cards, a wall, and the wildlings. The character cards are great because they give you another way to generate resources, and that helps so much. It helps kind of get some brick flowing when you're never rolling the dice, so absolutely no one has brick. It also creates ways for you to irritate your opponents, which can also be fun. The wall is an interesting mix because, of course, the wall goes along the northern border and it prevents the wildlings from coming across. And there's three types of wildlings. There's climbers who can just climb the wall and get on the other side. There's giants, and then there's just regular footmen. Giants automatically attack the wall and take out one of your guards. And then the regular ones don't really do much of anything. But if you get too many of the wildlings on the other side of the wall, it creates a breach. And if the wall is breached 3 times, everyone loses the game. And then the person who was in the lead gets a tragic victory, is what they call it. So it's like a win, but you didn't really win because technically everybody died due to the wildlings. When the wildlings come over the wall or create a breach, they cover a different resource, so then when you're rolling the dice, you can't get that resource anymore. Which, of course, makes it harder to get those resources that I said were easier to get because of the character cards. And if you have 8 wildlings covering different parts of the board at any time, you also lose, and the person who was closest to winning wins a tragic victory. So that's kind of how it works. I enjoyed it because keeping track of the wildlings just gave you another thing to do, and the game, the hero cards, gave you an opportunity to amass resources in different ways or irritate your opponents. But what did you think, Alyssa?
Well, my feelings are not about Catan. It's awful. I do like this better than regular Catan. Like, if I had the choice between this and regular Catan, I'd pick this. The wildling mechanics didn't seem to be much of an issue for us. That could also be because we weren't trading, like, longest road or that watch back and forth, those two victory points back and forth. Because when you do that, it does cause a lot of problems. So we weren't really building that much because our rolls were pretty bad. Just a good chunk of the game, which is standard for Catan. But the character cards definitely made it much more tolerable, because you use the character card, you flip it, and then you can either use that card again. It has the same, I think all of them have the same mechanics on both sides, or you can trade them out. You can't use the same one back to back, but you can trade it out, use it, get the one you want. Some of the mechanics for them are very annoying, like the one that lets you take things from the person with the most victory points. That was really obnoxious, but it added something extra to at least distract you from the fact that, you know, I haven't had sheep in 4 rounds. And I just need a sheep so I can hopefully draw another victory point card. So I can win this game and end our misery.
Yeah.
But compared to regular Catan, it's definitely better. I would be more, because of this, I would be more inclined to try Star Trek Catan or some of the other non-standard Catan versions that they've done.
That's fair. So where would you put this on a scale from 1 to 10? Just the like it.
We'll go with a 5. It's still Catan. It's working at a disadvantage because it's Catan. I would play it over Ice and Fire. Well, leave it at that.
I would put it at a 6. Because, yes, it is still Catan. And towards the end, it was feeling really long. Because, for one thing, the one thing we couldn't get was wood. Ha. Nobody could get wood. And it was a huge problem.
Not even player 3. That's no, surprising.
Poor thing.
Nope, player 3 was suffering of lack of wood as well.
I don't think I want you to know that.
Sorry. So that was a big issue for our game. And then the wildlings helped give you something else to focus on and did help with the strategy. But overall, still kind of slow. The minis are really cool. They look like they're 3D printed.
Mm-hmm.
The aesthetics of the game are really nice. I did go look at this game and found out that it is really expensive version of Catan.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. So yeah, I think it'd be a 6 for me because it's better than Catan, but it's still, there's better games out there.
I feel like if I liked Catan, this would be probably like a 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. But because I don't like Catan, I'm biased. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just going to say it. I'm biased. I think if you like it, if people like Catan a lot, or if it's something they play regularly, why not give it a go? If nothing else, play a demo at a local store or just purchase the game. I think it's solid for what Catan is.
Yeah.
Cool. Friend or foe scale. Yeah. You know, maybe we shouldn't do that for Catan because I feel like the only things you get truly angry at in Catan are the game itself. Because there's almost no way for the other players to screw you. It's always the game that screws you.
You could build a road in a place where they needed to build a road.
Yeah, but like,
oh, things I do every time I play Catan. Right.
But like at the same time, like that's just, I don't know, standard operating procedure. While, you know, the reason you hadn't built a road there yet is because you haven't gotten brick for 6 turns.
Yeah.
So, the only foe is Catan itself.
Yeah.
We have discussed replacing risk at the end of our levels of, at the end of our foe levels with Catan, because so many people in this room right now dislike it.
You mean all of them? All of the people in this room?
Well, except for me. I don't hate Catan. I just, there's better games.
Alright, well, Jackie's been replaced. Moving on. I'm replacing Jackie now. So next is Game of Thrones, Hand to the King. I disagree with that because I believe usually they're referred to as Hand of the King.
You want to double check it, Corp?
No, not really.
Okay.
So, it's a game for 2 to 4 players, also from Fantasy Flight Games, who, if you haven't guessed, has the rights to pretty much all of Game of Thrones. It's sort of a card-ish game. You make a 6x6 grid of characters out of these cards. The characters consist of characters from all a bunch of different houses.
You're right. It is Hand of the King.
Ah, nailed it, nailed it, nailed it. Dang okay, it. I'm a winner. So the 6x6 grid contains characters from all over, all kinds of different houses. So you have House Tyrell, Lannister, Stark, Greyjoy, etc., so on. Each house has a different amount of members of it. So Lannister's, I believe, has the most with 7.
Mm-hmm.
I think Stark's are pretty close. They might have 7 or 6. But your goal is to have the most members of certain houses by the end of the game. And the game, when you gain that majority of a house, you get that house's banner. And the banner can be stolen if someone gets more members. So if you claim the final member of a family, you get a companion card that has a special ability. And the game ends when there are no legal moves left. And so the moves that you do, one of the cards that's in the 6x6 grid is Varys, who, if you're familiar with the series, doesn't really have loyalty to any particular house, and has kind of shifted loyalties throughout the series. And so as you move his card throughout the grid in the spaces, you eventually run out of moves because it's very restricted on where he can move. You can only move in certain lines and can only move to a place where there's an open spot. When you move him to a spot, you can take any members of the house, of a particular house, that he passes over. So, for example, if you're moving him from one spot to another, and over that spot you pass over two Lannisters, you would take both of those Lannisters. The person with the most banners at the end of the game wins. So this is one of the only games today that I've gotten to play, because you can play it, especially as a two-player game, in like 5 minutes. It's super easy to pick up. It was kind of confusing for me at first, just because, like, I'm real dumb. So it took me a while to kind of get the hang of, like, where you could move Varys and, like, how you pick up those people. Because, like, I don't know why, but, like, the first time we were playing it, I kept thinking, like, I could grab all of the members of a house who are, like, touching in the grid, but that wasn't the case. So it's completely based on directional movement of the Varys card. Additionally, the companion characters all had really interesting abilities. I think there was even one that was, like, you get to go again or something like that. And yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of different ones that kind of just add a little bit of variety and change up each game that you play. So I kind of liked it. It was neat. It's a fun little, comes in a small box. The artwork is kind of a different take on most of what you see in Game of Thrones. Very less serious than most Game of Thrones art likes to take itself. So, Alyssa, what did you think of this game?
I actually liked it a lot, simply because it was something small, and it was easy to pick up, and it was quick to play. So, like, if I wanted to take it to work and just play on my lunch break, I could actually, like, play a game and not just, like, set it up and then have to leave. So that was kind of nice. And if I just wanted to play it with player three at home, it takes 5 minutes. There's no like massive commitment to like 3+ hours or a space commitment. We could literally just play it on the bed. It's not complicated. It's super easy to pick up, and then when we're done, we can just put it in my backpack. So, you know, it's nice, easy. I like the art style. I do like what Ethan said about it not being as serious. I think I liked the style that they picked for the art. The cards themselves were more like cardboard chips versus actual cards. If I remember right. So they're just going to be way more durable than if you had just bought like a regular card game as well, which is kind of nice.
I also like this game. Same reasons. Quick, easy to play. It was also very affordable, which is really nice. And in comparison to the last three games we've talked about, that's kind of a big deal. Because this one was like $12, and I can guarantee you none of the other three were $12. So that was really nice. It is quick to set up, easy to play, and it plays really well as a two-player. We did really well with it as a two-player. It worked fine as a three-player.
We knocked out, like, three games, too. Like, it was just boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a variant you can play where you actually play as teams, and I think that is something that is done because it actually does play better as a two-player. So you can basically make it work with four people as a two. But anyway, so that was really cool. I do love the companions. The companions really spice up the game and give it that extra level of being a little bit more strategic and not just I moved Varys over here, and now I move Varys over here. Because once you get the last member of a family, you get to pick one of the companion cards. Jon Snow, for example, counts as two for any house, so you could just add him to your houses and make sure that nobody's going to take him from you. That was pretty fun. I think it's Melisandre, actually, that gives you an extra turn.
Yeah.
And then there's some guy who I think is supposed to be some kind of, like, assassin that's in there, and he does three things. Like, he assassinates three different people, because he can assassinate somebody that somebody already has in their group of house members. and then he can assassinate someone who hasn't been picked yet, and then he can assassinate one of the other companions.
Yeah.
So he's kind of broken.
A little bit.
But it made it fun. So, Ethan, where would you rank this on the like it scale?
7.
And why is that?
It's pretty good. it's cheap and easy, just like I like it, you know what I mean?
You're not allowed to talk anymore.
Alright.
Alyssa, what did you think?
I liked it. I would probably put it, like, an 8. Like, if it was the tiniest bit easier to get some of the companions so they were more rotating in and out, that would be super cool. Because okay, but companions definitely made it more interesting than just, boop, 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 I move him, I'm gonna take all these guys. Good luck, kids. Yeah.
I guess I put it at a 7, personally, because it is really good, the art is super cute, the women characters are very voluptuous in true Game of Thrones fashion.
They got a lot of cleavage.
They do.
Woo!
So the art's good, game is solid. The only reason I wouldn't go higher with it is just because I just don't see myself breaking it out regularly. You know, this is a good in-between game, between two more heavy strategy games, or a good game, like you said, when you don't have a lot of time but you really want to play something. So it's not one that I just see myself going, man, I can't wait to get home so I can play a Game of Thrones, Hand of the King.
This is the game that you play in between playing games at a tournament.
There you go. That's a good one. It would be a good one to have at conventions, though, because you could totally just set it up on the floor and just while you're trying to wait for your feet to stop throbbing from walking around at conventions. You don't have that issue?
No, I just cut my legs off.
Ah, fair enough. Then you get to use a scooter.
I just go to bed.
Well, next.
Did we do friend or foe scale?
Oh, we didn't. Sorry.
Wow, slacker. Friend or foe scale. I'm going to say it's 0. It's nothing. It's like chess, you know. You don't get nothing in the game itself, you know, really screws you. So it's entirely strategy based, and it's a player skill challenge rather than anything mechanically that feels unfun.
Yeah, I'd go with the same thing. I mean, it's still competitive, but I mean, I could probably play like 5 or 6 rounds, and even if I lost like the majority of those rounds, I would still be cool with it. There's nothing that feels unbalanced that makes it be like, that's some shenanigans, I don't want to play this game anymore. It's more just, wow, I probably shouldn't have moved him that way. Oh well, that's life. We'll move on.
I guess I'd have to agree. It's almost an Uno because of the companions, and some of the companions have way cooler abilities than others. Other than that, it's barely an Uno.
Yay!
This is the Role-Playing Game Corner. For this month's RPG Corner, we're taking a look at A Song of Ice and Fire, the role-playing game published by Green Ronin Publishing. An interesting role-playing game system based off of the Game of Thrones novels and TV series. The edition I picked up of the PDF is the Game of Thrones edition. Appealing to a larger group of individuals who really caught on to the world after the show came out, this book illustrates a different way to think and play in the setting that George R.R. Martin created. Obviously, this setting has enthralled millions of people who watch it every Sunday on HBO, and as we approach the final season, many people may want to continue living in the world of Thrones. This system is different from, say, Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, as it uses a dice system based off of D6s. Your character's skills and abilities are based off of different numbers of D6s that you'll roll at any given time during the game. What would normally be referred to as the Game Master is referred to as the Narrator, as this particular system takes much more of a storytelling approach to the role-playing game genre. The game recommends having 10 d6 available. Your character will have plus and minus modifiers to their skills and abilities. and you are subject to tests, including basic tests, competition, and conflict tests that utilize your character's abilities. You create modifiers based off of several different statuses that your character may meet, and there are different modifiers created based off of their statistics and certain abilities, their house and their land holdings, as well as if you're given any assistance or penalties. Penalty dice are uncommon drawbacks imposed by wounds or flaws, and each penalty die cancels one test die when adding up your result. You apply the penalty after you roll and after you drop any bonus dice. The narrator then sets the difficulty for the task at hand, ranging from zero, which is an automatic success, to a heroic difficulty, which would be over a 21. These difficulties can be fit into any of the tasks that your characters may face, and giving a varied amount of success that your characters may find. Character creation is an interesting concept in this particular role-playing game. One of the first things you decide about your characters is the house and lands that they come from, which come in handy a little bit later on. You then come up with a concept for your character, the age, their status, and role. The roles in particular are the closest thing resembling classes that you would see in more traditional role-playing games. These roles go from expert, fighter, leader, rogue, and schemer, and have the ability to be meshed together, though the more of those roles you take, the less experienced and focused you are in certain abilities and specialties. You then choose the background for your character, including their goal, a virtue, a vice, and then you assign the abilities and specialties. Now, the abilities and specialties are parts that resemble closest things you'd expect to see in your traditional role-playing games, such as Dungeons & Dragons or Pathfinder. The abilities that you have are agility, animal handling, athletics, awareness, cunning, deception, endurance, fighting, healing, knowledge, language, marksmanship, persuasion, status, stealth, survival, thievery, warfare, and will. These include specialties such as acrobatics, charm, running, empathy, deciphering, logic, sneaking, reputation. All of these sorts of things go into these different abilities. And as you choose your character's direction, you can choose which of these specialties your character will be better at in the long run. In addition to these abilities that you assign as you build your character and the specialties you choose, you also get a resource called Destiny Points, which can offer you benefits if you spend them, burn them, or invest them. At any point, you can invest your Destiny Points into a particular benefit. The other thing about that, though, is you do can also get flaws and drawbacks that will change how your character reacts in certain situations. A lot of these qualities and benefits that you can get from Destiny Points, they act a lot like feats that you would expect to see, again, in D&D or Pathfinder. Whenever you voluntarily take a drawback, however, you gain one Destiny Point. You cannot have more drawbacks than you have benefits. However, when you gain a drawback as a consequence of a defeat, you do not gain a Destiny Point. And you may always burn a Destiny Point to remove the effect of a particular drawback you have gained. One of the most interesting parts of the things is the different statuses that you can achieve as your character. So it's based on a rank system from 0 to 10. 0 being a slave, 1 being common folk, and 10 being the king of the Seven Kingdoms. Basically, nobody is able to get past that 10 as far as their renown and status goes. But 9 includes the queen, the crown prince, or the king's hand, and 8 is a member of a royal family or warden of the north, south, east, or west. These types of statuses interact with how your character is able to interact in a court intrigue scenarios. The modifiers are based on how the other individuals involved, on where their status is. One thing about the house and lands part of this book that I found a little interesting is that it's almost an entire chapter just figuring out what sort of resources your character has available to them based on where they're from. It's a complicated algorithm, essentially, of figuring out where you get different modifiers from different things and rolling lots of dice. Now, if you're into that type of game, it's a lot of crunch for a heavy role-playing game. That said, there is more of a focus on mass combat rather than one-on-one, and you don't have to worry as much about, you know, a wizard casting fireball in your direction. If those are the kinds of games you're looking for, I highly suggest taking a look at this, especially if you are an enfranchised fan of Game of Thrones. If perhaps you're not as enfranchised, that's okay too, because the first chapter of this book is an introduction to Westeros, which if you have watched even a little bit of the show, you'll recognize some of those names, but it goes much more into detail about what the setting looked like a little bit before the series takes place. While you get a lot of that from watching the show or reading the books, this role-playing game book gives you just enough that you can base a character off of what's going on if you might not be familiar. My personal preference, if I were to be the narrator of a game of a Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game, is I like to know as much as I possibly can about a setting, so I would maybe go in and read through that section, plus an additional extra reading of the books and watch through of the show, perhaps, even just for some inspiration and ideas of how you want your game to run. One of the challenging aspects of these roleplay-heavy games that still have a lot of rules is knowing when exactly you should demand a role from your players rather than just letting the conversation go organically based on how the characters might think or react. That's something that I know I would have a tough time with as a dungeon master, and especially the time needed and spent calculating the different resources you have based on your house and lands. Honestly, that's really the only big critique I have about this rule set, is just the amount of work that goes into character creation and improvement when, you know, it's not like there's a lot of crunchy combat that you have to go through in order to get that. There are a lot of very interesting things that have probably been taken from older role-playing games, but really work for this Game of Thrones setting when you're trying to play a game of intrigue and conversation and perhaps warfare, because it does include some nice mass combat rules for you to utilize in those situations. One of the other interesting things I found is that it suggests that all members of the player characters be members of the same house, which makes sense because you want all of your players to play along with each other, but at the same time, you might have players who want to have allegiances to different lords and ladies. So it's definitely a game to check out if you're into the Song of Ice and Fire series. I'm excited to give it a shot and see if I can get some friends together to play this. Hopefully some friends who are a little more into Game of Thrones than, say, my other podcast hosts. So that is this episode of Meeple Skills RPG Corner. Join us next month when we will be talking about, I don't know, something else entirely.
The Kickstarter Highlight. So for today's Kickstarter Highlight, we're talking about Gloom of Thrones. It is a Kickstarter that's currently live right now by, I believe it's Atlas Games. The original Gloom is a card game for 2 to 4 players. You play as a family who you are actively trying to make miserable. So you play cards on your own family to make them miserable, and then you play cards on your opponent's family to try to make them happy. As soon as you get your family as miserable as you can, you then kill them off. Person with the most miserable dead family at the end wins. And that's the basics of Gloom. So now they have combined Gloom and Game of Thrones, which I think is probably the most realistic pairing I have ever heard. So this game very closely spoofs Game of Thrones. So it's supposed to be a little bit funnier. They have done stuff to make it a little bit lighter than I think the original Gloom was, because the original Gloom is actually kind of depressing as you play it. I've played Munchkin Gloom also, which was hilarious and definitely my favorite version of Gloom, because in that one you die for ridiculous reasons. Like, you can literally run into a wand that turns you into a ball of snot, and that's how you die. And so it's like, that kind of stuff is hilarious. And so they've done it a little bit funnier like that this time as well. And they've renamed the characters since it is a spoof version and not an accurate version. So you play as the Snarks, Bannisters, Kelly's Dragons, and the Brotherhood Without Pants. And as you play as these families, you try to make them miserable and kill them off while also giving your friends something to live for. So this Kickstarter is available until April 29th. It is $25 to kickstart the base game. The project is currently fully funded, so once it has come to a conclusion, you will be guaranteed to get a copy of the game.
Well, that does it for this month's episode of Meeple Skills, a very special Game of Thrones edition celebrating the final season of Game of Thrones. And frankly, I am not emotionally ready for that. So I will probably just listen to this podcast episode repeatedly for the next few months while I try and move on from Game of Thrones. But so that's what we got. Check us out next month when... What the hell's our theme?
Spring!
Springtime. In May, because that's what happens in May, right?
Well, we live in the Midwest, so it makes sense because it doesn't actually start to feel like spring until late April,
July, early May. Got it.
but yeah, we should be talking about Takanoko, photosynthesis, and maybe dinosaur tea party or dragon tea party. I don't know. There's so many tea party options.
Yeah, it's going to be themed around spring. You can just chill and find out what that is and listen to the podcast, and we'll make it a surprise.
Okay.
All right. Hold on. You can find us on the interwebs on the Twitter at Meeple Skills Pod. Instagram's Meeple Skills. You can follow me personally on the Twitter at NerdMeat. You can follow Jackie
at Jackie_Limmer.
She remembered it this time. I'm so proud of you. That's Alyssa, right. Are you on the interwebs?
Only on the gram.
The gram. Where can they follow your gram?
It's Minty Fresh Gaming.
Minty Fresh Gaming. I love that.
So much. I know, right? It's great.
You can also follow me on Twitch. Twitch.tv/NerdMeat_ because that bastard still hasn't given up my username. And make sure to follow the podcast on all of your favorite podcast apps, the Project-Nerd Podcast Network. Check us out on project-nerd.com. Check out all the articles that Jackie writes and that I sometimes look at. And make sure to check out Project Nerd on Patreon so they can continue to give you wunderbar podcasts such as all of the other ones that are on projectnerd.com, and sometimes even this one. Have a good night. Have a good month. See you in May.
Bye.
Bye.
Outro music.